Chapter 1. Joseph Smith, the founder of Mormonism, was born December 23, 1805, at Sharon, Windsor County, Vermont. His parents, Joseph Smith Sen and Lucy Mack Smith, belonged to the lowest grade of society, and by the testimony of all their neighbors, were illiterate and superstitious, as well as indolent and unreliable. They could believe in the supernatural as easily as the natural, for they were as ignorant of the one as the other. These qualities seemed to descend upon the son by ordinary generation, but at an early age he showed that he far excelled all the rest of the family in a peculiar low cunning, and a certain faculty of invention which enabled him to have a story ready for any emergency. In the year 1815, the Smith family removed to New York and settled near Palmyra, Wayne County, where they resided 10 years. Here young Joseph developed a remarkable talent for living without work, and at an early age adopted the profession of water witch, in which calling he wandered about the adjoining country with a forked stick or hazel rod, by the deflections of which, when held in a peculiar manner, he claimed to determine the spot where a vein of water lay nearest the surface. This had been a part of his father's business, but Joe was possessed of real genius, though of a peculiar kind, and soon struck into higher paths. He began to divine the locality of things which had been stolen by means of a peepstone placed in his hat, and by the same means to point out where hidden treasures lay. Almost innumerable are the stories of his youth, giving bright promise of future rascality, but many of them depend on little more than popular report, and we can only receive as authentic those events which rest upon the sworn testimony of reliable men who were his neighbors. After 10 years' residence in Wayne, the family moved to the adjoining county of Ontario and settled near the town of Manchester. Here, from pointing out the place for wells, Joe went to work digging them. While in this work for Mr. Willard Chase, a peculiar, round, white stone was found by him and the other workmen, which Joe took possession of and carried away, much to the regret of Mr. Chase's children, to whom it had been given as a curious plaything. This was afterwards the noted peep stone, in which Joe saw such wonders. Many of these statements are not very strenuously denied by the best-informed Mormons. They acknowledge, generally, that Joe Smith was of humble parentage, very poor and illiterate, and that he was for many years a wild boy. Brigham Young is especially frank upon the subject, adding, in conclusion, that the prophet was of mean birth, that he was wild, intemperate, even dishonest and tricky in his youth, is nothing against his mission. God can and does make use of the vilest instruments. Joseph has brought forth a religion which will save us if we abide by it. Bring anything against that if you can. I care not if he gamble, lie, swear, and run horses every day, for I embrace no man in my faith. The religion is all in all. Brigham is correct. The early character of the prophet has little to do with the religion, except as determining the character and credibility of his evidence. Let us then examine briefly the origin of this new theology, present the main testimony, and, as impartial judges, hear the prophet's account first. Many years after, when Mormonism was an established fact, Joseph gave the following account. At the early age of 15, he became much concerned about the salvation of his soul, and at the same time, a powerful revival of religion spread throughout Western New York. Joseph professed to be converted, and his mother, Sister Sophronia, and his brothers, Samuel and Hiram, so spelled by his father, joined the church. But when the revival ceased, a great rush took place among the ministers of various denominations as to who should secure most of the new converts. Joseph's soul was vexed, and he began to have serious doubts. In this frame of mind, he opened the Bible, and his eye fell upon this text. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, that giveth to all men liberally, and upbraideth not, James 1:5. He, therefore, retired to a secluded thicket near his father's house, and knelt in prayer, supplicating the Lord to know which of all the sects was really right. While praying, the entire wood was illuminated with a great light. He was enveloped in the midst of it, and caught away in a heavenly vision. He saw two glorious personages, and was told that his sins were forgiven. He learned also that none of the sects was quite right, but that God had chosen him to restore the true priesthood upon earth. Afterwards, he began again to doubt, and being quite young, fell into sin. and it was not until September 23, 1823, that God again heard his prayers and sent heavenly messengers to tell him his sins were forgiven. An angel visited him from time to time afterwards, instructing him in his duties, and finally informed him that in the hill Cumora, not far from Manchester, certain golden plates were buried, containing an account of the settlement of America before Christ. After several preliminary visits, on the 22nd of September, 1826, the golden plates were taken up from the hill Cumora with a mighty display of celestial machinery and delivered by the angel to Joseph. His vision being cleared, at the same time, he saw a great concourse of devils struggling with angels to prevent the work. The plates were of the thickness of tin, bound together like a book, fastened at one side by three rings which run through the hole, forming a volume about 6 inches thick. The record was engraved on the plates in Reformed Egyptian characters, consisting of the language of the Jews and the writing of the Egyptians. In the same box with the plates were found two stones, transparent and clear as crystal, the Urim and Thummim used by seers in ancient times, the instruments of revelations of things distant, past and future. When the news of this discovery spread abroad, the prophet was the sport of lies, slanders, and mobs, and vain attempts to rob him of his plates. He was ere long supplied with witnesses. Oliver Cowdery, David Whitmer, and Martin Harris make the following solemn certificate. We have seen the plates which contain the records. They were translated by the gift and power of God, for his voice hath declared it unto us. Wherefore we know of a surety that the work is true, and we declare with words of soberness that an angel of God came down from heaven and brought and laid before our eyes that we beheld and saw the plates and the engravings thereon. The testimony of these three is prefixed to all printed copies of the Book of Mormon, for such is the name now given to the work. Oliver Cowdery was at that time a sort of wandering schoolmaster, rather noted as an elegant scribe. He assisted in translating the inscriptions on the plates, continued an active saint for many years, and was finally expelled from the church in Missouri for lying, counterfeiting, and immorality. He led a rambling life for many years and died a short time since a miserable drunkard. Martin Harris was a credulous farmer who lived near the Smiths. He had imbibed the notion, so common in the religious excitement of that period, that the last days were at hand, and mortgaged his farm for $3,000 to pay for printing the first edition of the book. He continued with the Mormons till his means were exhausted, and, having quarreled with Joe Smith in Missouri, returned to his old residence in New York. Of David Whitmer, little is known. He dropped out of the Mormon community in one of the drives in Missouri and settled in that state. But the prophet had other witnesses. Soon after, four of the Smiths, three of the Whitmers, and another witness, eight in all, testify as follows. Joseph Smith, the translator, has shown us the plates of which hath been spoken, which had the appearance of gold, and as many of the plates as the said Smith had translated, we did handle with our hands, and also saw the engravings thereon, all of which had the appearance of ancient work and curious workmanship. According to Smith's account, he first met Oliver Cowdery, April 16, 1829, and after convincing him of his divine mission, on the 15th of May following, John the Baptist appeared and ordained them both into the Aaronic priesthood, after which they baptized each other. In July following, the golden plates were shown the three witnesses, and in that year the translation was completed. It was begun some time before, but suspended in July 1828, from the singular circumstance that the wife of Martin Harris had stolen 118 pages of the manuscript. As afterwards appeared, the translators thought she intended to wait until they had supplied the stolen part, then reproduce the original, and prove that they did not literally correspond. But it seems they had credited her with more cunning than she possessed. She had bitterly opposed her husband in his venture upon the new speculation, and had burned that part of the manuscript he brought home, hoping thereby to put a stop to the work. She afterwards attempted, by legal proceedings, to prevent the disposal of his farm, but failing in that, finally separated from him. The translation was then completed, Oliver Cowdery making most of the final copy. The Book of Mormon was first given to the world early in 1830 when 3,000 volumes were published under contract by Mr. Pomeroy Tucker, then proprietor of a paper in the county. He has, within a few years, given to the world a valuable work on the origin and progress of Mormonism, containing many interesting facts concerning the origin of the sect. The first proof sheet of the work was given by Mr. Tucker, as a sort of curiosity, to his cousin Steve S. Harding, whom he styles a fun-loving youth of that vicinity. Mr. Harding soon after removed to Indiana, and just 32 years afterwards was appointed by President Lincoln governor of Utah, whither he carried the proof sheet and presented it to the church historian. The Book of Mormon was rapidly circulated and attracted some comment. And at this point, a brief synopsis of this work is appropriate. It consists of a number of books named after their reputed authors: Book of Nephi, Book of Alma, Esther, Jared, etc. They contain the following history. In the reign of Zedekiah, 600 years before Christ, a Jewish family with a few friends and retainers left Jerusalem, being warned of God that a great destruction and captivity were at hand, and journeyed eastward in search of a land of promise. After many wanderings and the death of the patriarch, they reached the sea, when Nephi, who had succeeded his father in the patriarchate and priesthood, was directed by the Lord to build a boat, and, furnished with a double ball and spindle, which served the exact purpose of the modern mariner's compass. They embarked, and in due time reached the continent of America. Subsequent revelations have decided that they landed in Central America. There they increased rapidly, but a great schism arose, and one layman, with his followers, refused to obey the true priesthood, for which they were cut off, cursed, and condemned to be a brutish and a savage people, having dark skins, compelled to dig in the ground for roots, and hunt their meat in the forests like beasts of prey. But it was foretold that a remnant of them should, in time, have the curse removed and become a fair and delightsome people, who should blossom as the rose under the teachings of the Latter-day Saints. These were the Lamanites, the present Indians, while the Christian party were known as Nephites. The latter spread over all of North and South America, became rich and powerful, and built the cities of Zarahemla, Jacobugath, Manti, Gidgadoni, and scores of others, thus accounting for the numerous ruins found on this continent. They were ruled over successively by Nephi the First, Second, and Third, by Noah, Alma, Kish, Coriantum, and numerous other kings, and were successively instructed by a number of prophets. But the Lamanites increased likewise and carried on almost perpetual war with the Nephites, till a great part of the land was desolate. According to this history, there have been no people of the old world so warlike and bloodthirsty as these, and battles in which from 20,000 to 50,000 were slain were of common occurrence. The Nephites were troubled, too, by false doctrine, heresy, and schism. The true priesthood was reviled. One man arose and preached universalism, that God would save all mankind at the last day, and others followed strange gods. An immense mass of the nation turned back and joined the Lamanites, and a band of robbers under one Gadianton desolated a large part of the land. At length prophets appeared and announced the coming of Christ, who, after he was crucified at Jerusalem, preached the gospel in America. At the time of his death, this country also was shrouded in darkness. A mighty earthquake threw down the wicked city of Jacobugath, opened great chasms and basins throughout the land, and the whole face of the country was changed. The Nephites accepted Christ at once, but in a few generations fell again into apostasy, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of their enemies. The mighty chieftain Omondagus, whose rule was from the Rocky Mountains to the Mississippi, fought against the Nephites, and after him many others. Little by little, the Nephites were driven eastward, but made a stand near the shores of Lake Erie, and fought till the whole land was covered with dead bodies. They made their final stand about 430 A.D. at the hill Cumorah in Ontario County, New York, where the Lamanites came against them, and the battle raged till 230,000 Nephites were slain. The little remnant was captured, and only Mormon and his son Moroni escaped. The various kings and priests had kept a record of their history, which Mormon now collected in one volume, added a book of his own, and gave them to his son. The latter finished the record and buried the whole in the hill Cumorah, being assured of God that in 14 centuries a great prophet should restore them to man. Such is the book and Joseph's account of it. On such testimony alone, there is sufficient cause to reject it, the book itself containing abundant internal evidence of a fraud. Let us now glance at the opposing account. In the year 1812, a written work called The Manuscript Found was presented to Mr. Patterson, a bookseller of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, by the author, Reverend Solomon Spaulding. This gentleman was born in Pennsylvania, was a graduate of Dartmouth College, and for many years a Presbyterian minister. He fell into bad health, left the ministry, and finally died of consumption. The Manuscript Found was written by Spaulding as a historical romance to account for the settlement of America, and he proposed to Mr. Patterson to publish it with a preface, giving an imaginary account of its having been taken from plates dug up in Ohio, but the latter did not think the enterprise would pay. Sidney Rigdon was then at work in the office of Mr. Patterson. The latter died in 1826, and what became of that copy of the manuscript is not known. Mrs. Spaulding had another complete copy, but in the year 1825, while residing in Ontario County, New York, next door to a man named Stroud, for whom Joe Smith was then digging a well, that copy also was lost. She thinks it was stolen from her trunk. Thus far, all is clear, and there is no particular discrepancy between the two accounts. But when the Book of Mormon was published, the widow and brother of Solomon Spaulding and several other persons who had heard him read his work forthwith claimed that the new publication was nearly identical with the Manuscript Found, varying only in certain interpolated texts on doctrinal points. This claim was circulated abroad and caused Sidney Rigdon to write a highly slanderous and abuser to the press in regard to Mrs. Spaulding. Mormon historians say that Spaulding's book was a mere idolatrous romance, and that the whole story is the invention of Dr. Philastus Hurlbut, who seceded from the saints in Ohio and persecuted Joe Smith in various ways. The widow's and brother's statement is supported by the evidence of Mr. Joseph Miller, Sr., now of Washington County, Pennsylvania, who had often heard Spaulding read his work, by that of Mr. Reddick McKee, who formerly boarded with the Spauldings, and by others who knew of the work. Space fails to set forth all the evidence presented in support of this view. Suffice it to say that while it is of moral force sufficient to convince most minds, it is yet not such proof as would establish the fact beyond all doubt, or convict Smith and Rigdon of theft and forgery in a court of justice. If the proof were any less strong than it is, I would decide against the Spaulding claim, solely from the internal evidence of the book, for the style and matter are such as to raise a very strong presumption that it could not be the work of any man with intelligence enough for a minister, or of a graduate from Dartmouth College. But the true theory, no doubt, is that the writing of Spaulding was taken by Smith, Rigdon, Cowdery, and others as the suggestion and idea of their work, but was greatly modified and interpolated by them, leaving sufficient characteristics to be recognized by the Spaulding witnesses, who were left solely to their memory for a comparison with the Book of Mormon, recognizing what was in it and forgetting much that was not included. Of the three witnesses, it is unnecessary to treat. Their subsequent course shows what weight is to be attached to their testimony. The best evidence, furthermore, shows that Sidney Rigdon was the prime mover in the fraud, and that Joe Smith was conveniently put forward as the prophet. The year 1830 ranks as number one of the Mormon era. Early in the spring, the Book of Mormon appeared, and on the memorable 6th of April following, the Mormon Church was organized near Manchester. Six members were baptized and ordained elders, viz. Joseph Smith, Sr., Joseph Smith, Jr., Hiram Smith, Samuel Smith, Oliver Cowdery, and Joseph Knight, all but the last two of the original Smith family. The sacrament was forthwith administered, and hands laid on for the gift of the Holy Ghost. On the 11th of April, Oliver Cowdery preached the first public discourse on the new faith, and the same month the first miracle was performed in Colesville, Broome County, New York. On the 1st of June, the church, which had meanwhile gained a few more Whitmers and some others, held its first conference at Fayette in Seneca County. And the same month, Joe Smith was twice arrested on false charges, tried, and acquitted. Meanwhile, on the 18th of January, 1827, he had married Emma Hale, daughter of Isaac Hale of South Bainbridge, Shenango County, New York. And in 1830, she was, by special revelation, pronounced elect lady and daughter of God, afterwards more learnedly styled Electa Syria. She became thoroughly disgusted at her husband's religion while in Nauvoo and expressed no particular regret at his death. She refused to emigrate to Utah, but apostatized and married a Gentile, and is rather popular as landlady of the old mansion house at Nauvoo. In August of 1830, Parley P. Pratt, a young Campbellite preacher, came on a visit especially to hear of the new faith, and was at once converted, and soon after, Sidney Rigdon appeared as a leading Mormon. Their own history states that he had never heard of Smith until this time. Soon after, Orson Pratt was baptized, and the new church now had valuable material in its composition. The wild, poetical zeal of Parley, and the cool determination of Orson Pratt, the immense biblical knowledge and controversial skill of Sidney Rigdon, and the shrewd cunning of Joe Smith were united in the work of propagandism, and converts multiplied. In October, missionaries were sent to the Lamanites, and in December, Sidney Rigdon visited Joe Smith and preached several times in the vicinity. In January, Smith and Rigdon proceeded to the latter's residence near Kirtland, Ohio, preaching by the way. Rigdon had previously collected a band of nearly 100 persons who called themselves disciples, mostly seceders from other denominations, holding to a literal and rapid fulfillment of the prophecies, very fanatical and looking daily for some great event to occur. Many of these adopted the new faith at once, and a church of 30 was organized. By revelation of February 9th, the elders were commanded to go forth in pairs and preach, and it was ordered they should dwell particularly upon the fact that the last days were at hand. This idea is one that has a great hold upon many minds. Nor is it confined to the ignorant. Many intelligent men in every generation become impressed with the idea that in our day the world has become so corrupt that God Almighty is going to make a great change. And in spite of the plain declarations of Scripture, fanatics will wrest the mild precepts of the gospel and force them to indicate that hellfire and destruction are impending over everybody but their own particular sect. The Mormons began as millenarians, and that of the maddest sort. But they did not preach that the world itself was to be destroyed, only that destruction was soon to fall upon all who did not embrace the new gospel. No particular time was set for this consummation, but it was understood to be imminent. Early in 1831, John Whitmer was appointed church recorder and historian, and about the same time, the remaining New York saints came to Kirtland, which is set down in Mormon annals as the first Hegira. On the 6th of June, the Melchizedek, or superior priesthood, was first conferred upon the elders, and soon after, Joe Smith had a revelation that the final gathering place of the saints was to be in Missouri. He set out the same month with a few elders, and in the middle of July, reached Jackson County, Missouri, where another revelation was granted that this was Zion, which should never be moved, and the whole land was solemnly dedicated to the Lord and his saints. They began at once to build and laid the first log in Kaw Township, 12 miles west of Independence. Another revelation of August 2nd fixed the site of the Great Temple 300 yards west of the courthouse in Independence, which spot was accordingly dedicated by religious exercises, which were followed by a great accession of gifts. On the 4th of August, another large party arrived from Kirtland. A general conference was held in the land of Zion, and in another revelation vouchsafed to Joseph that the whole land should be theirs and should not be obtained but by purchase or by blood. Just what was to be understood by that strange wording, it is now impossible to tell. The Mormons explain it very innocently, and the Missourians construed it to mean that the saints would unite with the Indians and drive out the old settlers. Joe Smith returned to Kirtland the latter part of August, and soon after established a mill, store, and bank. The last was what was then denominated a wild cat bank. That is, it had no charter and deposited no state bonds for security, but rested solely on the individual credit of the proprietors. As several wealthy men had come into the new organization, the notes of the bank circulated at par. Joseph Smith was made president and Sidney Rigdon cashier. For the next 5 months, Joseph traveled and preached in the northern and eastern states, making many converts who gathered either at Kirtland or in Missouri. The elders sent out in February previous had met with tolerable success, and Samuel H. Smith, brother of the prophet, had added greatly to the church by converting Brigham Young. This noted personage was born at Whittingham, Windham County, Vermont, June 1, 1801. He had four brothers and six sisters, all of whom became Mormons. He was baptized in April 1832 by Eleazar Millard and soon after gathered at Kirtland. He was brought up on a farm and learned the trade of painter and glazier, which he followed till after his conversion to Mormonism. In him, Joe Smith recognized one born to rule, and his deep cunning and wonderful knowledge of the weak points in human nature soon gave him a leading position in the church. In March 1832, Joe Smith and Sidney Rigdon, while absent from home, were tarred and feathered by a mob for attempting to establish communism for forgery and dishonorable dealing, according to their adversaries, by their own account, for the truth's sake, and this is set down as the beginning of persecutions. Early in April, Joe Smith found it necessary to go again to Independence, Missouri, where a sort of ecumenical council was held and a printing office set up. In June was issued the Morning and Evening Star, the first Mormon periodical edited by W.W. Phelps. Joe Smith soon returned to Kirtland, and the latter part of the same year, Heber Chase Kimball was baptized into the church. In February 1833, Joe Smith finished his inspired retranslation of the New Testament, and soon after received a revelation to square things in Zion. A quorum of three high priests, Joseph Smith, Sidney Rigdon, and Frederick G. Williams, was organized as Presidency of the Church, and they were at once favored with visions of the Savior and concourse of angels. By the spring of 1833, the Mormons numbered some 1,500 in Jackson County, Missouri. They had taken virtual possession of Independence, where their paper was published, and were fast extending their settlements westward. The intense religious excitement, which raged throughout the United States during the decade of 1820 to 1830, which led to the wild phenomena of jerks and so-called religious exercises of howling, jumping, barking, and muttering, seems to have left a precipitate of its worst materials in Mormonism. They daily proclaimed to the older settlers that the Lord had given them the whole land of Missouri, that bloody wars would extirpate all other sects from the country, that it would be one gore of blood from the Mississippi to the border, and that the few who survived would be servants to the saints, who would own all the property in the country. As their numbers increased, arrogance and spiritual pride took possession of them. They proclaimed themselves kings and priests of the Most High God, and regarded all others as reprobates, destined to a speedy destruction. In conversation with the Missourians, they never wearied of declaring that all the churches established by the latter were alike the creation of the devil, that they were under the curse of God and all their members doomed, castaway Gentiles, worse than heathen, and unworthy of longer life. At the same time, it does not appear that there were any more violations of law among them than would be among the same number of very poor and ignorant people anywhere. But their general conduct was insufferable. In the first flush of their religious enthusiasm, they seemed to have been governed by no ideas of moderation. They proclaimed through the country that it was useless folly for Gentiles to open farms. The Lord would never allow them to enjoy the fruits of their labor. They notified the workmen upon new buildings that they could never hope to be paid therefor, and generally proclaimed that in a very few months, the Gentiles would have neither name nor place in Missouri. The simple-minded Missourians listened with a vague wonder to their first predictions, then smiled at their confident boastings of superior purity and holiness, but soon their increasing numbers and arrogance awakened serious fears of the future. The Missourians, unaccustomed to the language of hyperbole and prophecy, interpreted their predictions to mean that the saints themselves would be the ministers of God's vengeance and smite the unbelievers. Many were incensed against them for their language, and the public mind was greatly inflamed. In April 1833, a number of Missourians came together in Independence and decided that means of defense ought to be taken, but determined upon nothing. The first June number of the Morning and Evening Star contained an intemperate article headed Free People of Color, which excited the wrath of the old citizens against the Mormons, as abolitionists, and was answered by a small pamphlet headed, "Beware of False Prophets." As summer advanced, it appeared that the Mormons would be sufficiently numerous to carry the county at the August election, and this roused all the fears of the old settlers afresh. Without apparent concert, an armed mob of 300 assembled at Independence, tore down the newspaper office, tarred and feathered several of the saints, whipped two of them a little, and ordered all to leave the county. Oliver Cowdery was started to Kirtland to consult with Joe Smith, but during his absence, the saints agreed with the citizens to leave Jackson County. On the 8th of October, W.W. Phelps and Orson Hyde presented a memorial to Governor Dunklin of Missouri, praying for redress, to which that officer made answer that they had a right to the protection of the law if they chose to stay in Jackson. Emboldened by this, they refused to leave according to agreement, and the last of the month the mob again rose, burnt 10 Mormons' houses, and committed a few other outrages. The Mormons armed in turn and fired into a portion of the mob, killing 2. The whole body of citizens then arose against them, calling in aid from other counties, when the Mormons became panic-stricken and suddenly evacuated Jackson, crossing the Missouri River during the nights of November 4th and 5th into Clay County. This first expulsion of the Mormons is a point upon which there has been much discussion. That the people of Jackson County were not justified in law is plain, but that they did exactly as the people of 9 counties out of 10 would have done is equally plain. They seem to have been actuated much more by a fear of what the Mormons would do when they had the power than by what they had done. And that those fears were well-founded is abundantly shown by subsequent events. The near vicinity of the Mormons was intolerable, and the settlers were determined they should leave. The mob allowed the saints to carry their printing material to Liberty, Clay County, where they soon after began to publish the Missouri Inquirer. They spread themselves over Clay into Van Buren County, but were persecuted and annoyed in the latter, so they made no great settlement. Meanwhile, Joe Smith and a much more intelligent class of Mormons were building up Kirtland. July 2, 1833, Smith completed his inspired translation of the Old Testament, and soon after, a printing press was set up in Kirtland, and the Latter-day Saints messenger and advocate established. Old Man Smith, the prophet's father, was made patriarch and Bishop Partridge head of that branch of the church. When the news of affairs in Jackson County reached him, Joseph determined on war and began at once to collect a small force. He soon had 200 men with whom he started westward, marched on Missouri, according to Gentile history, hoped to redeem Zion, according to Mormon annals. About this time, Joseph had another revelation as to business, which will be found in the Doctrine and Covenants with the rest, which contained, among other directions, this remarkable passage. "Behold, it is said or written in my laws, thou shalt not get in debt to thine enemies. But behold, it is not said at any time, the Lord should not take when he pleases, and pay as seemeth to him good. Wherefore, as ye are on the Lord's business, whatsoever ye do," etc. We need not be surprised, therefore, to learn, as we do from Joseph's autobiography, that the people along the road were very hostile. 2 days before starting, on May 3rd, the Conference of Elders in Kirtland repudiated the name of Mormons and adopted, for the first time, that of Latter-day Saints. And we notice in Joseph's account that along the road they constantly denied the name of Mormons. These being the last days, they were Latter-day Saints, as well as to distinguish them from the saints of former days. The term Mormon, on the contrary, is supposed to be derived from the Greek momov, mormo, signifying a horrible fright or bugbear. Joe and his army reached Missouri in the latter part of June, but while near the Mississippi, the cholera, then but just known in America, broke out in his camp, and in a few days 20 of the company died. Joe preached, prayed, and prophesied in vain. His followers were panic-stricken at the horrible and unknown disease. He first attempted to cure it by laying on of hands, but desisted with the remark that when the Lord would destroy, it was vain for man to attempt to stay his hand. An armed force which had meanwhile gathered in Jackson County in anticipation of his coming was scattered by a violent storm, and in a few days, the cholera having spent its force, the company reached Liberty. There was nothing to be done, and in a few days Smith returned to Kirtland. A quorum of 12 apostles was then organized, among them Brigham Young and Heber C. Kimball. The former received the gift of tongues and was sent on a mission to the eastern states, and in May 1835, all the 12 left Kirtland on general missions. The ensuing August, there was a general assembly at Kirtland in which the Book of Doctrine and Covenants and the Lectures on Faith by Sidney Rigdon were adopted as the rule of faith. About this time, a learned Jew, formerly professor of Oriental tongues in New York, was connected with the Mormons, and on the 4th of January, 1836, a Hebrew professorship was established at Kirtland, Joseph Smith and several other leading Mormons entering upon the study. A temple had been projected early in the settlement, which was completed and dedicated as the House of the Lord, March 27, 1836. This was their first temple, and its estimated cost $40,000. Meanwhile, Governor Dunklin had attempted to have the Mormons again put in possession of their lands in Jackson County, whereupon a committee of citizens from the latter met a committee of the Mormons and offered the following. Proposition of the people of Jackson County to the Mormons. The undersigned committee, being fully authorized by the people of Jackson County, hereby propose to the Mormons that they will buy all the land that the said Mormons own in the county of Jackson, and also all the improvements which the said Mormons had on any of the public lands in said county of Jackson, as they existed before the first disturbance between the people of Jackson and the Mormons, and for such as they have made since. They further propose that the valuation of said land and improvements shall be ascertained by three disinterested arbitrators to be chosen and agreed to by both parties. They further propose that should the parties disagree in the choice of arbitrators, then is to choose them. They further propose that 12 of the Mormons shall be permitted to go along with the arbitrators to show them their land and improvements while valuing the same and such other of the Mormons as the arbitrators shall wish to do so to give them information, and the people of Jackson County hereby guarantee their entire safety while doing so. They further propose that when the arbitrators report the value of the land and improvements as aforesaid, the people of Jackson will pay the valuation with 100% added thereon to the Mormons within 30 days thereafter. They further propose that the Mormons are not to make any effort ever after to settle either collectively or individually within the limits of Jackson County. The Mormons are to enter into bonds to ensure the conveyance of their land in Jackson County, according to the above terms, when payment shall be made, and the committee will enter into a like bond with such security as may be deemed sufficient for the payment of the money according to the above proposition, etc., etc. The Mormons have always maintained that their later troubles were solely on account of their religion, but that they were driven from Jackson County because the mob desired to get possession of their lands. The above document certainly tends to disprove that charge. The foremost men in the county offered their personal security for the payment, but the Mormons rejected the proposition on the ground that the Lord had said Zion should never be moved. The citizens of Jackson then became apprehensive that they would be attacked from Clay County, and stirred up those in the latter county who considered they already had cause to complain of the Mormons. So they requested the latter in May 1836 to remove, which they did, this time settling in Carroll, Davis, and Caldwell counties. In the last named, they founded the town of Far West, and these counties being new and unoccupied, they prospered greatly for a while. In June 1837, the first organized foreign mission was sent to England, consisting of H.C. Kimball, Orson Hyde, and W. Richards. On the 30th of July following, they baptized the first converts there, in the River Kibble, and the first confirmation of members was at Walkerford, August 4th. The first conference of English Mormons was held in the cockpit at Preston, the 25th of the following December. In the autumn of the same year, the Kirtland Safety Society Bank, engineered by Smith and Rigdon, failed under circumstances which created great scandal, and the prophet had a revelation to depart for the land of Zion in Missouri. Smith and Rigdon left Kirtland between 2 days, and their creditors pursued them for 100 miles, but in the language of Joseph's autobiography, the Lord delivered them out of the hands of their persecutors. They reached far west in March and found a fearful schism raging in the church. The authority of Joseph was unequal to the task of restoring order, and Martin Harris, Oliver Cowdery, and 1 L.E. Johnson were cut off from the church, while Orson Hyde, Thomas B. Marsh, W.W. Phelps apostatized and brought many serious charges against Joe Smith and other leaders. It was said they were plotting treason against the state, that they were conspiring with the Indians, that they were engaged in counterfeiting and cattle stealing, and were attempting to establish a community of goods as well as wives. The dissenters stirred up the neighboring people against the saints, and for purposes of defense and retaliation, the Danite Band was organized. They were first commanded by D.W. Patton, who took the name of Captain Fear Not and styled themselves Daughters of Gideon. Afterwards, they adopted their present name from the suggestion in Genesis chapter 49, verse 17. Dan shall be a serpent, by the way, an adder in the path that biteth the horse heels so that his rider shall fall backward. On the 4th of July, Sidney Rigdon preached what he called Sidney's Last Sermon, in which he threatened Gentiles and apostates with violence and declared that the saints were above all law. Troubles soon after arose in Davis County at elections, the Mormons all voting one way secured control of the county. A general fight occurred at the August election in the town of Gallatin, in which a number were seriously wounded on both sides. For 2 months, there were occasional fights all over Davis County, and the Mormons at length declared their independence of all earthly rulers and magistrates. The clerk of the county, a Mormon, was commanded by Joe Smith to issue no more writs against the saints, and the justice of the peace in Gallatin was mobbed for entertaining suits against them. Scattering parties of militia began to assemble under arms in the neighboring counties, one of which, commanded by Captain Bogart, came to battle with a party of 70 Mormons and defeated them. Another party of Mormons attacked the militia near Richmond in Clay County and killed two of them. The latter returned the fire, killing Captain Fear Not. The Mormons then rose en masse and drove out all the officers of Davis County, not of their faith, and burned and plundered the town of Gallatin, another small village, and much of the surrounding country, driving out the inhabitants. About this time, Brigham Young fled for his life to Quincy, Illinois. The troubles grew so extensive and complicated that after many attempts to learn something definite from the seat of war, Governor Lilburn W. Boggs called out 15,000 militia to restore order. The first detachment had a sort of battle with the Mormons in Carroll County, after which Governor Boggs issued an order that the Mormons should be expelled from the state, adding, even if it was necessary to exterminate them. This is the celebrated exterminating order, and Governor Boggs, the Nero of Mormon historians. Another body of militia were fired upon by the Mormons at Hahn's Mill, and in revenge exterminated the whole Mormon party, variously estimated at from 16 to 30. Only two escaped alive. The Mormon forces then began to retreat on every hand and finally united in the town of Far West, where they were surrounded by a large militia force under Generals Doniphan, Lucas, and Clark, and compelled to surrender at discretion. Most of their plunder was recaptured and delivered to the owners, and the great body of the Mormons were released under a promise to leave the state. Joe Smith, Hiram Smith, and 40 others were held for trial, and the militia officers forthwith organized a court-martial and condemned several of them to be shot. But General Doniphan, a sound lawyer and brave man, by a firm use of his authority and influence, prevented this foolishly illegal action. The prisoners were taken before the nearest circuit judge and put upon trial for treason, murder, robbery, larceny, and breach of the peace. They could not well have been tried for more, but it seems by the evidence that many of them were guilty on most of the charges. They were committed to jail to await their final trial. The evidence in the case was printed by order of the Missouri legislature and presents a singular instance of how a few knaves may lead to their destruction, a whole people, if sufficiently ignorant and fanatical. Comparative peace was restored. But the history of civil commotions shows that private revenge will seek such a period for its gratification, and in many neighborhoods, fearful outrages were perpetrated upon individual Mormons by those who held a personal animosity against them. Their leaders had provoked a conflict for which the innocent suffered, and the most quiet and unoffending portion of the Mormons were hunted out and rudely hurried from their homes at the most inclement season of the year, often without a chance to supply themselves or dispose of their property, and much suffering was the result. They now numbered over 12,000, and in the month of December, this large body began the journey into Illinois, which the most of them reached in January 1839. They spread over the western counties wherever they could find food or employment, particularly about the town of Quincy in Adams County, while many went as far east as Springfield and others to St. Louis. They were everywhere received as sufferers for their religion and to some extent for their free state sentiments. For Illinois was just then beginning to be agitated by the anti-slavery excitement, and the Mormons had been driven from a slave state. The Missouri border had never been well spoken of, nor was it till long afterwards, and the Illinoisans rather seemed pleased with the opportunity of showing how superior they were to the border ruffians. They regarded but little the Mormon statement that their religion was the only cause of trouble. In fact, the more intelligent knew that such could not be the case, but they made haste to assume that the Mormons were New York and New England Yankees driven out as abolitionists, because the Missourians would not tolerate such sentiments. The people of Illinois, particularly of the western counties, knew little and cared less about differences of speculative theology. That portion known as the Military Tract had but lately come into market and was settled very rapidly. The religious training of the people had not kept pace with the advance of their material interests, and a sermon to them was a sermon, whether preached by Arminian or Calvinist, Orthodox Trinitarian or Heterodox Unitarian. Perhaps they were not impious or skeptical. Religion was at loose ends, but there was always a sentiment in its favor. Only sectarianism was little understood, talked of, or cared for. In short, the charity of these people was broad enough to cover all sects, and no man was persecuted or called in question for his religious belief. Under these circumstances, they gave the Mormon people protection and welcomed them to their homes and tables. They listened to the story of their wrongs with tears in their eyes. They grasped the outcasts by the hand and swore to stand by them to the bitter end. Subscriptions were opened for them in many places. Even the Indians, yet upon a near reservation, contributed liberally, and several sections made kindly overtures, and pressingly invited the fugitives to settle among them. They had not yet caught sight of the cloven foot of the monster, or seen its miscreated front. The Missourians found in the meantime that they had caught an elephant. They had Joe Smith, his brother Hiram, and 40 others in jail on a multitude of charges. But many of the witnesses were gone. The trial would have been long and expensive, and it was probably the best policy to get them all out of the state in such a way that none would reenter it, rather than condemn a few to the penitentiary. Accordingly, they were removed from place to place, loosely guarded, and on the 15th of April, Joseph and a few others escaped from their guards, who were either drunk or pretended to be. They hastily made their way to Quincy, followed by the small remnant of Mormons which had been left at Far West. The remaining prisoners escaped and followed soon after, and in the language of Governor Boggs' next message, the young and growing state was happily rid of the fanatical sect. But in the language of Mormon poetry, Missouri, like a whirlwind in her fury, drove the saints and spilled their blood. Early in May, Joe Smith went to Commerce in Hancock County, Illinois, by invitation of Dr. Isaac Galland, from whom he obtained a large tract of land near the head of the Des Moines Rapids, and shortly had another revelation for his people to settle there. To a proper understanding of their future history, a brief sketch of the locality is necessary, which has been kindly furnished me by R.W. McKinney, Esquire, present postmaster at Nauvoo, who has resided in that vicinity since 1837. Hancock is a river county, washed on the west by the Mississippi for 40 miles, taking into account the windings of the river. It was originally nearly all prairie, extending eastward in a direct line from Commerce 25 miles, high and rolling, with a soil of inexhaustible fertility, and with most of the timber fringing the streams along the eastern border. The western part of the county, bordering on the Des Moines Rapids, was always a favorite spot of beauty to the voyager on the Mississippi. The eye was here relieved by a most inviting prospect. The river was fringed by low wooded hills, from which gushed clear and sparkling brooks, passing with low musical murmurs over their rocky beds until they were finally lost in the Father of Waters. But the early progress of Hancock County was anything but encouraging. While other sections of the state, with fewer advantages and a less healthy climate, rapidly augmented in wealth and population, this remained almost a wilderness, and this by reason of uncertain titles. Hancock County, fair, healthful, and fertile, even as the Garden of the Lord, was one of those unfortunate counties comprised in that afflicted section lying between the Illinois and Mississippi rivers, known as the Military Tract. It had been set apart by act of Congress as bounty land for the soldiers of the War of 1812, but few of them emigrated there, and nearly all of the patents, or soldiers' rights, as they were called, were thrown upon the market for sale. This furnished for a score of years a rich harvest for speculators and land jobbers, and the Military Tract became the happy hunting ground of sharks and sharpers of every description. A race of bloated patent holders was thus created, whose broad tracts of wilderness land rivaled in extent the proudest dukedoms and baronies of the Old World. It was against sound public policy to create such a land monopoly on the public domain, but much greater evils grew out of this thing in the establishment of a conflict of titles, creating doubt and uncertainty, casting a shadow on every man's homestead who dared to erect it on the tract, and driving away honest and enterprising settlers. A system arose in the East of forging patents by having absent or deceased soldiers represented by others, and even by making duplicate copies entire without affidavit or aid from the land office. In hundreds of instances, there were three patents upon the same section, with facilities to make 1,000, in fact. The entire tract was eventually strewn with patents as thick as autumn leaves in an unbroken forest. So great grew the evils of this system, and from the non-payment of taxes by non-residents, that the legislature of Illinois went to work to devise a remedy. But the legislators of new states are not generally very learned or capable statesmen, and the sharpers laughed at the idea of illiterate men thwarting the plans of men whose business it was to pierce the center of the most explicit statute. The legislature, having tried sharp and pointed statutes on the fraternity before, but without success, instead of tinkering and amending laws which John Doe et al. Had laughed at, tried the virtue of a more sweeping enactment. They enacted, in substance, that if anyone held possession of land for 7 years under color of title, such possession should be proof of title conclusive against all the world, and that John Doe et al., with their pockets full of patents, should be forever barred and excluded. When John Doe and his compeers took in the force of this statute, not a smile lit up their solemn countenances. They were caught at last. But everybody was disappointed by the final operation of the statute. It only created or attracted another swarm of flies, more hungry, voracious, and pestilent than any that had preceded them. The heavens and the earth were darkened by their myriads, and no friendly swallow appeared to drive them away. No sooner was the delinquent list exposed for sale for non-payment of taxes than a crowd appeared in and around the courthouse, hungry and haggard, the like of which had surely not been seen since Pharaoh's lean kine emerged from the River Nile. Here were congregated broken-down tradesmen, tinkers and vagabonds, rough, roaring, swearing fellows, and smooth-faced, hypocritical, canting knaves, jostled each other, and mingled and commingled in the halls of justice, each one striving with the few dollars he had contrived to save out of the general wreck by cheating his creditors, to retrieve his fortunes, and the result was a land monopoly more corrupt than any that had preceded it. The law had been aimed at the non-resident jobber, to compel the payment of taxes, but this unscrupulous crowd hurled it without mercy or discrimination at the heads of everybody. If it carried away the inheritance of the widow and orphan, it was all the same to them. The wise legislators stood aghast at the havoc they had innocently caused. They had called spirits from the vasty deep, and contrary to all past experience, they had come. These sharpers inspired general terror, and no wonder. For had the incongruous and villainous crowd made a descent into hell, the devil would have fled howling to the most retired and gloomy corner of his domain, leaving them to contend and squabble among themselves for a tax title on his burning throne. It was now an indiscriminate fight on the military tract, in which all sorts of persons, with all sorts of papers, documents, and titles, rushed to the conflict and couched their lances for the fray. In this hot contest, the unsophisticated settler, not conversant with these matters, had but little show. He could much more readily, with the slightest possible assistance, read his title clear to mansions in the skies, than so establish his claim to a single foot of land covered by soldiers' rights, forged patents, and tax titles on the whole military tract. Fortunately, Hancock County was not altogether covered by these titles. The act granted the soldier 160 acres of land, no less, no more. Hence, those quarters called fractional, with less or more than 160 acres, were subject to entry at the land office. These skirted the banks of the river and along the township lines of the whole county, and were rapidly taken up and settled before the arrival of the Mormons, at which time Hancock County contained a sparse population of several thousand. Owing to greater security of title, most of them were settled along the Mississippi. The Des Moines Rapids excited much attention as a favorable site. Among the conspicuous men who visited this section was General Robert E. Lee, then a lieutenant of topographical engineers in the employ of the War Department, for the purpose of making a survey of the rapids. His visit was in 1832, and he remained in the county the whole season, and was favorably known to all the old settlers, and much respected for his urbanity and gentlemanly bearing. It was then a favorite idea with some that the Mississippi would in time be bridged at these rapids, and that at no other place could a permanent structure be erected. Hancock was organized as a county in 1829, and the capital permanently established a few years after at Carthage. Meanwhile, the courts traveled around the country after the manner of a public exhibition, holding terms at such points as met the views of the lawyers, or perhaps where it was considered that law and justice were most needed. Among the lawyers who then practiced Hancock were Malcolm McGregor, Archibald Williams, and O.H. Browning. The former, a brilliant genius, died young, and the latter two have since become known to fame. First in history was a post office at the Rapids, called Venice, but there was no town of that name. In the year 1834, commerce was laid out by Messrs. Alex White and James B. Tees, and shortly after a Mr. Hotchkiss of New Haven, Connecticut, laid out Commerce City, just above the other town. All proved failures, but many still had confidence that this was the place for a great city in the future. Among the owners of the bottom land was Dr. Isaac Galland, a man of some enterprise who, immediately after the failure of Hotchkiss, opened a correspondence with Joe Smith, which resulted in an agreement that the latter should settle all his people near Commerce. To the foregoing graphic sketch, it is only necessary to add that the prophet purchased a small tract and received gratis a larger one. A convenient revelation was vouchsafed for the saints to gather to this stake of Zion. They complied with rapidity, the plat of a great city was laid out, and the Mormon star was once more in the ascendant.